Hello, I'm Mel Gertov, and welcome to another episode of the Global Citizen Interviews. I'm in this series, what we try to do is interview with people who are expert on matters of immediate international concern, and certainly nothing is more immediate than the state of U.S.-Russia relations and the situation in Ukraine. It's a privilege and pleasure to introduce a Russia expert. Professor Oral Braun is professor of international relations and political science at the University of Toronto. He's been a visiting professor at Harvard and is now an associate of Harvard's Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Professor Braun has written and lectured extensively on Russia and East European affairs, among others. He's the author of a number of books, including NATO-Russia Relations in the 21st Century. And he's been recognized by the Canadian government for his work on human rights and in general for his academic distinction. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Oral Braun to the Global Citizen. And I'd like to begin the questioning with a more general matter, and that is to get his assessment of Russia today in the latest era of rule by Vladimir Putin. So, Oral, what's your general sense of where Russia is headed these days?
There is the general impression, and that is one of Vladimir Putin winning and winning and winning. He managed to reinsert Russia in the Middle East when Russia had been pushed out. He has taken over Crimea and ex-Crimea, and he appears to have got away with it. He is prodding and probing the NATO states, intimidating or trying to intimidate the Baltic states as well. With the energy crisis and the climate crisis in the world, the prices of energy have gone up, and over 60% of Russia's exports consist of energy. So we get the sense of this constant momentum of one foreign policy success after another. But the reality for Russia is a very different one. Russia is, as we know, the largest state territorially in the world. It has phenomenal human resources and unparalleled natural resources. And for all of that, Russia, which is a remnant of the Soviet Union, is a wretchedly poor country. It is racked by corruption. Corruption is endemic. It is corrosive. Russia is not a modern state. Russia cannot compete internationally in economic terms, despite scientists who are absolutely at the cutting edge. If you use the kind of 30-year rule, which I like to employ, and you ask yourself, what did Germany or Western Germany, Italy, Japan look 30 years after the devastation of the Second World War? Well, that would take us to 1975. By 1975, the former Nazi, fascist, militaristic states were thriving democracies with highly competitive economies, having created a modern society. Look at Russia. The average Russian now is poorer than the average Romanian or the average Turk. They've grown less in the past 7 years at a much lower rate than Poland, Romania, Hungary. So in that sense, Russia has failed anywhere even remotely close to achieving its potential. It has missed window of opportunity after opportunity. And these seeming foreign policy successes are camouflaging a very dire domestic situation.
So when we look at the way Putin has have been fairly aggressive in foreign policy, is this a matter of personal desire for greater power, or is he hiding, or is he projecting onto the international stage an effort to mask domestic problems and, in fact, as you have put it, great weaknesses?
Well, you've asked an extremely important question here, because we know that foreign policy starts at home. Henry Brandon wrote that, and Richard Haass wrote an entire book about it, and that's not unusual. I mean, domestic policy always influences foreign policy, but it is rare that the intertwining is so tight, that the domestic determinants are so preponderant as they are in Russia. And that is that Russia is, in some ways, to put it in an unflattering way, under the Putin government, it is a nationalistic kleptocracy, where a good deal of the wealth is in the hands of a privileged oligarchy, and the people of Russia are quite poor, even though, as I noted, there are all those human and natural resources. So I would argue that Russia is really facing four major domestic crises. And so Putin has tried to divert attention away from those crises, which he cannot solve, or he's not inclined to try to solve, by looking at foreign wins to compensate for that. But that is also subject to its kind of own laws of diminishing returns. You cannot indefinitely just sway the people by telling them that we are respected internationally, we are feared internationally, never mind what is happening domestically. And the four crises that are, I think, primary motor forces for foreign policy would be a legitimacy crisis, an economic crisis, an identity crisis, and a succession crisis. And they're all intertwined. And the legitimacy crisis, which is a political kind of crisis, despite opinion polls, which don't mean that much in Russia because there's no real opposition, they have been crushed, and the media is controlled largely by Vladimir Putin. He has manipulated the public by using what I call the kind of political magical realism, drawing on the notion of magical realism that was used by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. We combined the fantastic and the real. It's very effective in literature. It's deadly in politics because it doesn't really work. So it's more than a personality cult. You see Putin built up to almost superhuman kind of attributes where, you know, he's flying on motorized gliders, saving rare birds, and finds treasures on the seabed that were pre-positioned that archaeologists could not find, and so on and so on. And you have a kind of combination here of the risible and the repressive, a toxic cocktail that ultimately retards the development of the country. But this depended, in a sense, on economic progress. And that economic progress has not been happening in the past several years because there's only so much that you can get out of energy prices if you don't modernize the economy, if you have a unidimensional economy. You can see that the economy has been performing really poorly in the past many, many years. And this kind of trickle-down effect that they had, that yes, the oligarchs got richer and richer, but the population was basically told, you are going to get a constant increase in the standard of living, not a great deal, but you can count on it. And in return, the tacit social contract is you will not challenge us politically. That is beginning to fall apart. And you saw in 2011, 2012, very large demonstrations, and you saw some more the past couple of summers, even though they're smaller, they're not less significant.
If I could just interrupt, I can't help thinking of the parallel there between Putin and Xi Jinping in China, a similar social contract, but with different results.
Well, the Chinese managed to become massive exporters, and they had grown the economy because the work ethic did not die out as much in China. And of course, you're the expert on China, and you would be able to tell us a lot more. And I suspect that China is not quite as powerful and successful as it seems to be.
Because
those are the lessons that we learned with East Germany and in Eastern Europe, that the assumptions that we made about the GDP, about the efficiency of communist states, it turned out to have been overestimations. But in the case of Russia, they are not even successful exporters. You know, I do not know anyone who's driving a Russian car. I do not know anyone who's using a Russian laptop. I do not know anyone who's taking Russian medicines. If they are, they should stop it, because I wouldn't recommend it. And so Russia has failed to become a modern, diversified economy because they try to keep political control. And Russia also has the third element. It's an identity crisis, because the Soviet Union was an empire. Now, the Russian Federation is not quite the same. And this is why you see Putin trying to restore the Russian empire, trying to move into Ukraine is part of that, this kind of pining for the past. And you see some Russians who are saying now, well, Russia is not really a European state. It's a Eurasian state. And that's kind of a new identity. For 300 years, Russia has been European. That's what the bulk of the population is. So it's very difficult to create a new identity. And that comes up against the Ukrainian identity, which the Kremlin denies.
Yes.
And then there is a succession problem. There is no succession process put in place, except the constitutional amendments that were made, which will allow Putin to stay in power indefinitely. But we know, Mel, that there is something called Stein's law. If a trend cannot continue, it will stop. And despite the wonders of Botox, Putin eventually will stop. He cannot live forever. And maybe it lasts into his mid-70s, late 70s. Theoretically, he could stay in power until 2036 in one form or another, until the age of 83. But there has to be a succession, and that could be very, very volatile. So there are all these domestic issues, and Putin has tried repeatedly, with considerable success on occasion, to divert attention away. That comes right out of the toolbox of dictatorship, that you find some external conflict, and the population then is focused on that. But eventually, it's just not enough. And this is why you see Putin taking such harsh action against all opponents. This is why people have been assassinated, the people in the press who oppose them. This is why they attempted to poison Navalny. And then they imprisoned him and outlawed his movement, because even though opinion polls only give him 15 to 20%, the Kremlin knows that that could grow very quickly. So they want to squash any possible opposition early on. They fear that they don't want to have an alternative.
Yes, and beyond Navalny, whom I wanted to bring up at some point, but maybe we could do that here. It just seems that there is a systematic quashing of civil society in Russia. That extends, you know, just as in China, it extends to journalists and other political opponents. You have the memorial situation. So it's really quite a broad brush way to deal with any possible source of opposition.
Well, clearly the Kremlin views civil society as a major danger. And so many Western analysts, very good people, people I admire, but I disagree with some of their assessments. They view Russia as a country that, having suffered historically from invasions, which of course is true, and wishing to have some buffer zone, is expressing certain fears about NATO enlargement and other matters. But in fact, I think what Russia, the Kremlin that is, fears the most is not NATO, it's not the EU. What they fear most is democracy. And this is one of the things that they fear about Ukraine, that Ukraine could turn out to be a Slavic democracy, and they cannot afford to have a large Slavic democracy of 40 plus million people on its borders that is successful and still try to maintain that dictatorship. And so outside of certain geopolitical ambitions, and it's not a binary matter, one or the other, it's a combination. But I think more than anything else, that's what the Kremlin fears. And you will notice that the crisis of Ukraine didn't begin through a NATO enlargement. It was when Ukraine chose to oust Yanukovych, and they did not want to go along with this Eurasian Union, and they expressed an interest in having closer ties with the EU. So why would Russia fear the EU that much? Well, the enlargement of the EU or the involvement of the EU helps promote democracy, helps promote civil society, helps promote free press, helps promote the rule of law. These are all things that pose a central danger to the Kremlin.
Yes, I want to, I'm glad you mentioned that, because Ukraine is the obvious next subject. And if a Russian associated with the Kremlin were here now, of course, he or she would say that, no, the real issue is the Western intrusion into Ukraine, the providing of its leadership with lethal weapons, and most importantly, the possibility of its association with NATO. Is this entirely a false issue?
I would suggest that it's largely a false issue. I'm not dismissing Russian fears of NATO enlargement. I mean, that is almost built into the psyche of Russia, any kind of Western movement closer to its borders. But I think it pales in comparison to what is the real danger that they view, is that is the danger of Ukraine that is democratic, that is successful, that would present an alternate vision of development to what Putin is trying to sell, which is autocracy and orthodoxy. And that is something that they simply cannot tolerate. I mean, let's not forget that Ukraine, at the time of its independence, was a country that gave up a vast nuclear arsenal. Now, they did not have the codes for it, but I think they could have figured out the codes eventually. But they gave up the nuclear arsenal in exchange for guarantees by Russia, by United States, by Britain, that their independence and sovereignty would be respected. It was the best memorandum. And so it was hardly a case where Ukraine was an aggressive military country that was rushing, jumping into the arms of NATO and posing a danger. On the contrary, Ukraine was a state that made an enormous amount of sacrifices, giving up what could have been an incredibly important deterrent, because they expected that they would have peaceful relations. Can you imagine if Ukraine would have nuclear weapons? I doubt that Russia would have risked invading Crimea.
Yes, interesting speculation there. On what?
And I'm not suggesting that they should have nuclear weapons.
Right.
I'm just suggesting that this kind of argument that Ukraine poses some kind of armed threat is not realistic. I mean, they just don't have the army. And sadly, Ukraine has been also a corrupt society. If you look at the perception index, the Transparency International, Russia ranks at 129, which is horrible, but Ukraine is at 117. So it's not exactly a society that has been terribly successful, but it has potential.
Yes, it does have potential. And the situation in Donbas with Russians still there, and not to mention the many troop deployments on the border, all suggest a very tense situation subject to miscalculations and misperceptions. What's your sense? I mean, there's been a lot of speculation, as you know, about Putin's intentions with those troops, including the Washington Post's finding of an intelligence report from within the U.S. government, I guess from the CIA, suggesting that Putin is waiting to build up those forces to about 175,000, after the first of the year, when the potential for an actual invasion might occur. How do you deal with that report?
My reading of Putin, to the extent that we can read anyone, is that he's ruthless, but he is not reckless. And the pattern has been that he exploits weakness and gaps. And he tries to read Western leaders. And unfortunately, the record of dealing with Biden is not an encouraging one. Because let's not forget that Biden was vice president at the time that Russia, they just had invaded Georgia, right. And then in 2009, January, the new administration came in, and it was that administration where Biden was vice president where they engaged that disastrous reset button, which sent entirely the wrong message to Putin, which was that the West will live with these occupations, invasions. And there was a small test case. And that, I think, played a large role in Putin deciding in 2014 that he could safely risk going into Ukraine and that there would not be effective retaliation. And that on a cost-benefit analysis, it made sense. And I think in a way it did, because they also had the signal in Syria, where basically the administration at that time, where Biden again was vice president, they subcontracted the removal of chemical weapons from Syria, which allowed Russia to reinsert itself into Syria in a major fashion. So again, that sent a signal that business as usual would continue, that they would find some common interest they can work on, would all fight terrorism and so on. And the result was that Putin had an ability, therefore, to signal to the Russian people, and his popularity skyrocketed at the Crimea, that, look, we are winning. We are maybe not a superpower now, but we're on the verge of becoming a superpower, or at least we are an independent, great global power. And in a way, it was a demonstration that using force can pay if you do it carefully and exploiting weaknesses. And I think this was kind of expressed in a very kind of brutal, crude way by Dmitry Rogozin, who was at one point the ambassador to NATO. Then he became one of the deputy prime ministers, and he was in charge of defense industries, and is now in charge of Roscosmos. He's a very crude guy, but he said, when he was asked about sanctions, tanks do not need visas. Tanks do not need visas. Now, Russian diplomats have been much more subtle, much more nuanced about it, but this seems to be a kind of doctrine that force followed by pressure, especially on the Europeans, where the argument is made, who's more important to you, Georgia or Russia? And the answer was, well, Russia. Who's more important to you, Russia or Ukraine? Well, Russia. And so the Kremlin is basically saying, we want not only respect, and every country deserves respect, including Russia. What they're saying is, we want deference. We want to be able to exercise a veto on Ukrainian policy. We want to be able to exercise a veto on domestic politics inside Ukraine. And if we concede on that, then I don't know what the next crisis is going to be. So it's a kind of tough situation. But if our intention is, and you know, Blinken made a statement, which was a reflection of what President Biden said, and that was that we are committed in an unwavering fashion to Ukraine's territorial integrity, sovereignty, and independence. Well, when you make that kind of statement, you have to stick by it, because you cannot make such unequivocal statements and then you don't back it up.
Right. So the question is, besides that statement, which certainly is the most unequivocal, I mean, Secretary of State Blinken has also tried to issue various warnings recently to the Russian via the Russian foreign minister. Are these sufficient deterrents, considering where things stand, in actuality on the front lines?
It's a very dangerous situation. This is where signaling is so important, because I don't think Putin intends to invade Ukraine at the moment. But often conflicts, as you know, Mel, start as a result of miscalculation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And missignaling. It could just escalate from certain incidents in the Donbass to something that just gets larger. And so that's why signaling has to be very clear. It has to be consistent. And when you take action, it has to have teeth. It doesn't mean that the United States will deploy troops in Ukraine. That's highly unlikely. But we can reinforce Poland and Romania, because they're under pressure from Russia. Russia is engaged in a kind of hybrid approach. They don't like the term hybrid warfare because it's too restrictive, but there's cyber war, there's information warfare, there can be economic responses. The Russian economy is very vulnerable. If you take them out of SWIFT, they can't transmit things. Economically, they cannot transmit finances and so on. They can be actions taken against the group around Putin, because one of the ways the oligarchs have managed to protect their wealth is by parking it overseas. That makes them vulnerable. You can go after that. We can help Ukraine, not just militarily. We can help Ukraine with COVID, sending vaccines there, making sure that that is an exemplar. In Russia, the people don't want to take the vaccines because they don't trust the government. They do not trust Russian vaccines. The Russian Sputnik vaccine apparently is not bad, but there's no trust. And the Kremlin had said repeatedly the Western vaccines are unreliable. So they're in a difficult place. But in Ukraine, Pfizer and Moderna would help them a great deal. So we could do that as well. You can send defensive armaments to the Ukrainians, more training for troops. So there is a great deal that can be done in terms of signaling, but it has to be done urgently, has to be done consistently. And what has to be made clear to the Russians that there's no intent to invade Russia. It's ridiculous, we don't have the capacity. But at the same time, Russia would face not the kind of sanctions that they had before, but absolutely devastating sanctions. And unfortunately, there's also this problem where at one level, we want to move forward in dealing with climate change, which I think is real and urgent. But in moving away from fossil fuels to renewables, that has put Russia in a position where it can use more leverage, because whereas we are stopping exploration, where the pipeline from Canada, as you know, Keystone, the United States was blocked, Russia is completing a pipeline that would bring fossil fuels to Germany.
The Nord Stream project, yes.
The Nord Stream 2, making them even more dependent. So the Biden administration, which decided to go along with the completion of that pipeline, needs to go to the Germans and say, no, that has to stop. Yes. If you commit to climate change and so on, you'll have to find other means. So there's a lot that we can do, which we have not done.
Mm. On the Russian side, some people have speculated with this question, why hasn't Russia seized the Donbass region? A very large salami cutting project. Why? What has deterred it from doing that?
Well, at the moment, they're busy digesting Crimea, and it's expensive. I mean, Russia, as I noted, is not exactly a successful economy, and there's just so much money they can afford. And if they took over the Donbass entirely, That in a poor region with Rust Belt industries, that would require a vast amount of subsidies. They're putting some in, but they would need even more. It could also alarm the West more, and they don't want to do that. They want to do it more by stealth. You know, the time has not come yet where they feel that they have to take that drastic step, but perhaps they will in the next few months, especially if there is sufficient temptation. If Vladimir Putin can calculate, as he did in the case of Georgia, that they will get away with it, as in the case of Syria, that they will get away with it. Because let's face it, in Syria, they propped up one of the most murderous regimes on the planet and did so successfully, and they got away with it. And in the case of Crimea, illegally annexed Crimea, and they got away with it. So in the Donbass, if they think they can get away with it, perhaps they would do that. And so the signal that has to be sent is that you won't get away with it. It's not going to be business as usual, that there would be really drastic repercussions that would so damage the Russian economy, that would so turn NATO against Russia, that would so reinforce and lead to a more vigorous and stronger NATO that Russia does not want, because they can't really compete with that. I mean, look at the size of the Russian economy. Those would be unmistakable signals. But so far, the Biden administration has not done that. I mean, in the spring, Mr. Biden concurred with a reporter's characterization of Putin as a killer. It was a very harsh thing to say, but he concurred with it. And then he asked for a meeting. And what happened at that meeting? He didn't get any concessions from Russia. Following that meeting, Russia has been even more aggressive, even more confident in pushing against the countries on its borders. So I don't think the record of Mr. Biden has been encouraging so far, and hopefully this will change, because if not, that's when we risk real escalation, not because there is this kind of grand strategic plan that Putin has, but rather because he is opportunistic and he will act when there's weakness and he can be tempted.
If you're correct, and I would agree that that Putin ultimately is not reckless, and if these various possibilities of sanctions plus the deterrent statements that have been issued from Washington do cause him to come up short, Where does that leave the situation in Ukraine as far as a possible diplomatic solution goes? Is the Minsk, the last Minsk Accord of, what was it, 2015, is that just out the window, a dead letter? Or is there some prospect for a revival of talks that would, for example, lead to a demobilization in the Donbass region, and some kinds of security assurances to Russia about Ukraine's future? Are there any avenues there for de-escalation via diplomacy?
A diplomatic solution is always preferable to a military solution, because we know every time there's military escalation, it's highly unpredictable. And once you are in an actual conflict, then it really gets out of hand. So one ought to avoid that at all costs. But the track record of the Minsk agreement is not a good one. It's not a good one because Russia was very greedy. I mean, they had a terrific deal under Minsk, an almost veto, because the accords in Minsk sort of imposed an obligation on Ukraine to basically have to consult with the Donbass region on all sorts of steps. And the Russians had they used that cleverly, and they were more moderate and more patient, they could have blocked all sorts of developments, including possibilities of Ukraine joining NATO or joining the EU, and that would be fine for the future. I mean, Ukraine is not about to be accepted into NATO and the EU. They're not ready. They have not met the criteria. But the Russians wanted a great deal more. And the question is, would they settle for something like Minsk going back to it as a first step in what their ambition is? Because I think the ultimate ambition is to make sure that Ukraine fails, that Ukraine fails to become a successful democracy in a modern state. That is what the Kremlin cannot afford to do. So the Kremlin has been, their approach has been to be an utterly disruptive force. They do not accept the legitimacy of Ukrainian nationhood. The Russian, or the Kremlin, I should say, propaganda has been that there is no such thing as Ukrainian identity, that this is something falsely created by the West as a tool to use against Russia, that they are one people, that Kievan Rus is the heart of where Russia started, and that consequently, if only they push enough, the Ukrainian people will come to their senses and they will rejoin Russia in creating this new great Slavic empire. The reality is, as one Russian analyst said, that Putin won Crimea but lost Ukraine. Because it was not a strong enough Ukrainian identity before 2014, there is one now. And that identity is becoming sharper and sharper. And so this is why a diplomatic agreement will be very, very difficult to achieve given the overall goals of Russia, which are virtually unlimited in terms of controlling Ukraine. And so it's hard to see how there could be a genuine diplomatic solution which would be fair to Ukraine. And that is, that would allow the people of Ukraine to build a society that they choose, not the one that we want them to choose, not the one that Russia wants them to choose, but they should choose. I mean, 43 million people ought to be able to choose their own fate.
Yes, if self-determination has any reality at all. I'm struck by how the situation does have some parallels to China and Taiwan, with Chinese claims on one side about the inseparability of the mainland from Taiwan and all that is really not in accord with the with Taiwan realities, where you have a very distinct society which becomes even more distinctively Taiwanese, the more pressure that is put on it by the PRC. So it's a very difficult situation. And the fact that you have leaders, namely Putin and Xi, who seem to have made unification with Ukraine or with Taiwan as a personal ambition, you know, to upgrade their historic legacy.
Well, you would know this more than anyone else, and I'm wondering about this, if I may ask a question, that if Russia were to invade not just Donbass, all of Ukraine, and take Ukraine over, would this perhaps encourage China then to move militarily against Taiwan? Is this a successful Russian action in Ukraine?
Well, I think the two are actually quite separate. You know, even if the, you know, analytically they appear to be similar. I don't think the Chinese leaders would be so inclined, so reckless as to think that they could use that as an occasion for or a justification even for invading. Or in some other way attacking Taiwan. I think the U.S. commitment to Taiwan is a lot stronger in reality than it is to Ukraine. You know, even though it has its, you know, the strategy is supposed to be one of ambiguity, but I think it's a lot more than that. So,
it's a lot closer. There are no perfect analogies, of course. And there is one other matter. I mean, it would be wonderful for the people of Ukraine if they had achieved the same level of economic success as in Taiwan.
Indeed.
And the same level of political stability. They're nowhere close to that, but the hope is that they could achieve something like that.
Yes, I mean, there is, in that sense, Taiwan is a thriving democracy, and not to mention a thriving economy. And yes, it is a model. It is a model, even though it's a small country. Well, I think we'll have to stop here, unfortunately, because it's been a wonderful conversation with you. I'm so glad to hear your expertise, Professor Oral Brown of the University of Toronto. Take care. I hope health and safety are for you and yours and the good folks in Canada. Thank you so much, Oral, for taking part in this interview.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Bye.
Bye-bye.